Thursday at 6 o'clock, Oval Office Patio. We'll bring the beer. Well, the date seems to be set for the meeting between Harvard professor Henry Louis Gates Jr. and Officer James Crowley to meet with President Obama at the White House. Obama seems to be hoping the event is both a teaching moment and a chance to turn down the dial on the tension on the event that's kept the attention of America for days and shined a spotlight on race, power, and politics in America. Good morning. I'm Veronica Rickert. Glad to be with you here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Kathleen Dunn is out this week. This morning, we're joined by Andra Gillespie. She's an assistant professor of political science at Emory University, who's written about the Gates incident on Politico.com. And we're always happy to hear from you as well. Has the Gates incident brought racial profiling to your mind? Should Obama apologize for his comments about the Cambridge police? And how do the dynamics of changing power in America come into play? You can reach us this morning at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or send us your email to talk@wpr.org. And Andra Gillespie, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
So it's out there right now, the eve of this big meeting between Henry Louis Gates Jr. and his arresting officer, James Crowley. What do you think of Barack Obama's approach here, this kind of let's all just get together and hang out like real people approach? Do you think it's an honest one?
I think it is an honest one. We aren't going to solve the racial problem over a beer on the White House lawn because most of us won't be there. But these are precisely the types of conversations that need to happen on a micro level in order for us to see macro change.
And what do you expect can come out of this?
Well, what I think will come out of this is that the news cycle will eventually get tired of this story. So once this meeting has happened, I'm assuming that this story will fall out of the news cycle. The other thing that I expect to happen is that Professor Gates and Officer Crowley will see each other as human beings and also recognize how just sort of general human factors such as tiredness and ego probably got in the way of good judgment and sort of allowed them to see each other as caricatures as opposed to sort of human beings being involved in a misunderstanding. And hopefully the president can be able to mediate the misunderstanding so that the two of them don't hold any animosity toward each other.
Well, you're feeling pretty positive about it then. How do you expect what happens there under lock and key will filter out to the rest of us? Are we going to really know what happens?
I'm not sure. I think at this point, even with, Lucille Whalen kind of coming out and defending her side of the story, because of the way news cycles go, I think this story is pretty much dead after tomorrow evening. And so because of this, I don't know if we really are going to know what happened and what didn't happen. And I think on some level, that actually doesn't bode well for, a continued dialogue on race relations and racial profiling, at least not at this juncture. It's probably going to take another incident for us to have a real honest discussion about these issues.
I wonder if you're right. On one level, I wonder if this will all be dead by the next news cycle after the meeting on Thursday, because there is so much flap about it right now, and America is very engaged with this story. And I think maybe, unless something bigger hits, they'll want some sort of resolution that's more than a quick and easy, we're all chums now.
Well, I think the resolution is going to be different depending on who you talk to. So for those who were inclined to side with Officer Crowley, they already have all of the information and the data that they need to sort of be justified in their position. And for those who have thought that Professor Gates was right all along, they have their data to sort of substantiate their particular point of view. Because of the way news cycles go, I don't know if we're really going to get to a place where we're actually going to figure out what the truth is or who's really right or wrong or who is more right or more wrong. That's the unfortunate sort of consequence of the world that we live in and the way the news business runs. But, this is a very complicated case, and this is an issue where there is no clear-cut good guy or bad guy. And so because there isn't a clear-cut good guy or bad guy, this isn't going to be the type of incident that sparks outrage and reform, unfortunately.
You don't think so, because it has really shined a spotlight on certainly the idea of racial profiling mm-hmm. and whether that's what's going on here. And Jesse Jackson has gotten involved saying, he's hoping that we look at this more closely. President Obama, the president of the United States, is involved in this, which seems pretty unprecedented.
Well, it's unprecedented because we've never had a black president before. Somebody who may, in fact, be very intimately, familiar with the concept of racial profiling and may have had it hit home, if not for him, then for somebody in his family. And so for that reason, it has taken on a national issue. But you know, we look at the case, Lucia Whalen, the woman who made the initial phone call, was not engaging in racial profiling. When she made the phone call, she couldn't even tell what race the gentlemen were who were breaking into the door. She conceded that they may, in fact, live there. You have a police officer who has a history of having taught people not to racially profile, being accused of racial profiling, and you have a professor who jumped to conclusions and got agitated and fell into this vague sort of line of what is disorderly conduct and what isn't disorderly conduct. So, you know, it's not quite the, you know, Rosa Parks incident where you have this clear, upright, upstanding woman who refuses to give up her seat out of a sense of very controlled, righteous indignation sparking a movement. This is a case where, you know, you don't have a Bull Connor. James Crowley isn't Bull Connor. And so it's not clear who the good guy is and who the bad guy is. And that's the problem with studying and talking about race relations today, is that unless it's a really outright egregious case of racial violence or racial discrimination, there are going to be people who argue that this is racial discrimination and that there are going to be people who argue that it's not racial discrimination. And that's what makes this discussion so difficult, and it makes it easy to table the issue until we have that big smoking gun or that huge incident where it's very clear that something very unjust happened, and this just isn't one of those cases. And so for that reason, it's going to lose its cachet once it's been resolved personally between the parties who are directly involved.
Well, there are members of Congress, well, there's at least one that I saw on CNN last night, who is clamoring for President Obama to apologize for what he said, and is threatening various actions there. Is this something that's going to come back to haunt the president? Already he's been accused of, but, you know, he sort of stepped on his own headline, as it's been put, because of his health care reform. At the very end of his press conference, he makes the remark about the officer behaving stupidly. Mm-hmm. And you just wonder what this is going to reveal about him.
Well, I mean, I think his stand actually revealed a lot about him. President Obama has been very, very careful to not talk about race unless he absolutely had to. We saw that during the campaign where he ran a very race-neutral political campaign. And we suspect that a lot of voters were attracted to Obama precisely for the fact that he was a black man who didn't wear his race on his sleeve, who didn't talk about race. The burning question for students of African-American politics is, we know that when blacks run as racial moderates, they attract more support than if they run as more race-conscious candidates. But there haven't been enough blacks who have used this campaign strategy, who have held high political office, for us to really see what happens when they get into office. Mm-hmm. So when you get backed into a corner as an elected official and you have to take a stance that may be unpopular among some of those people who supported you because you weren't like all those other black politicians, what do you actually do? So this was the first time that Obama actually took a stand on race as president. There have been other incidents that happened when he was a candidate and, you know, early on in the presidency where he didn't say anything about it, and civil rights leaders have been somewhat critical of his silence on those issues. He takes a stand in favor of Skip Gates, and he experiences a backlash. And so it will be really interesting to see what happens the next time there's a racial incident. Particularly right. One that involves African-American voters. It may very well be that he's gun-shy in the future because of that, especially any time before 2012 when he has to run himself for re-election. We may see, and in fact, my initial prediction was that he wouldn't talk about race at all until a second term if he got one, because then he would be a lame duck, and then he wouldn't have to worry about the, you know, re-election imperative. So it's going to be very, very interesting to see how he handles this going forward. And I think he was somewhat surprised that that comment got the attention that it did. And we've seen that there are still misunderstandings that even amongst people of goodwill, who are not people who we would classify as bigoted, we see that that same racial divide in public opinion still persists, with black people viewing this experience through the lens of their own experience and whites viewing this incident through the lens of their own experiences. And that chasm of experience leads to differences in perceptions and differences in how they judge it and what policy outcomes should be. So we still have a ways to go in terms of bridging the divide between people who see the world differently because of race and racism.
Well, I think you're right. I think it's what happens down the road that should be really fascinating to watch. But even now, it seems as though people don't know quite how to view Obama's role in handling national issues of race. On the one hand, if you look back to the lead-up months to the election, he gave the watershed speech on race, which is sort of his, you know, let's get it out there, people, let's talk about it, I want to talk about it. And that was viewed as a pretty big deal and a monumental moment in American politics, him as a person who would talk openly about it, who wanted to talk about race and address the issues that were lingering out there. And then on the other hand, people are surprised by his remark in this case, because it seemed to crack his code on discipline. It didn't seem to be what he would have intended to say, maybe necessarily politically. So it's confusing about how President Obama is viewed.
Well, okay, so and going back to the More Perfect Union speech last March, that wasn't a speech of let's be open and talk about race. That was a Barack Obama being backed into a corner and watching his campaign about to implode and Hillary Clinton about to gain the upper ground and him having to talk about race. So he only talked about race because the Jeremiah Wright incident forced him to
It
have
forced
to talk
him
about
to
race.
It, but he seemed to embrace the moment, and a lot of people seemed pretty impressed by it.
Yeah, but they were pretty impressed by it. But if you look at how he handled the incident, it was still very much a very even-handed, blacks have some resentments, whites have some resentments, everyone's perspective is valid, let's figure out how we can bring it all together. Sometimes when you're dealing with racial issues, sometimes it's that people have valid perspectives and we need to bridge the divide, but sometimes there's a right side and there's a wrong side. And when you have a right side and a wrong side, you're going to alienate part of your constituency. And his comments last week actually stood to alienate one side, because if you take the side of Officer Crowley, then you are going to be upset by those comments. And if you say that racial profiling is wrong, then that is going to put one important group of your constituency on the defensive, because that means that there are times when you can't bridge this together by talking. Sometimes you have to say this is right or this is wrong, and these people have the power of the vote. They have the right to have some say in whether or not this man keeps his job. So in that respect, it was risky. And for that reason, I actually don't view the, you know, Philadelphia speech as being, you know, terribly risky or actually that progressive, despite all of the laudatory praise that it got last year. He did it because he had to, and he didn't really take any sides. He was too busy trying to take both sides, and people like that, and it's very electorally expedient, but that doesn't actually further the discussion about race. It keeps things very civil, which is important, and I think, you know, it is a very good thing. But sometimes we can be so civil that we don't actually deal with issues that are very important. It's like, you know, the dysfunctional family that keeps up appearances, that helps to contribute to keeping up appearances without actually delving into the heart of the issues. Sometimes it's going to be ugly. Sometimes people are going to get their feelings hurt. But generally, after you've had that big blow-up argument, you have a period of catharsis. And that's where real healing happens. And that hasn't happened in this country yet.
So looking at this micro-incident then between Henry Louis Gates Jr. and James Crowley, is this a moment then where Obama is really just kind of backing out of the picture, taking himself, even though he's going to be there, it's, you know, in his house, so to speak, it's a moment where he's saying, I'm Switzerland and I'm just going to let the two of you work this out.
I think that that's probably the way that it's going to be. It'll help to create the photo op that puts a cap on the story so that people can move on to focusing on issues that are important to all of us, like healthcare reform.
So you don't see legislation coming out of this, maybe new legislation about racial profiling, for instance?
No, and it's in part because the facts of the case are not clear-cut. So it's really hard to tell who's the good guy and who's the bad guy in this situation. And by all accounts, Henry Louis Gates could have handled this situation a little better. So he probably wouldn't have gotten arrested if he hadn't lost his temper. And so, rightly or wrongly, we can argue the merits of whether or not you can get arrested for losing your temper, but if cooler heads had prevailed, we wouldn't have heard about this story. It's only because Skip Gates got arrested that, you know, we ended up hearing about this story. And because of the fact that Lucia Whalen didn't actually come forward until the end of this news cycle, we are really not going to answer the question as to whether or not somebody in the Cambridge Police Department lied or embellished the police reports. Because if we listen to, you know, what came out earlier this week, she didn't mention race at all. It had to be pushed to even come up with a racial description of the suspected burglars. But in the police report, all of a sudden, it's two black men in
right.
a backpack. And nobody's talking about that. That suggests that there was something racial going on here. But by the time this comes out, and by the time you've heard that Crowley's a good guy and he's got the support of his black fellow police officers and that he taught racial profiling, it looks like Henry Louis Gates was presumptive, jumped the gun, played the race card before he needed to, and that Jim Crowley is getting persecuted. And that's probably not exactly what happened, but because everyone's kind of got a little dirt on their hands, this isn't one of those clear-cut cases where you can rally around it and use that to actually push forward legislation.
Well, we've got a lot of folks waiting to talk to you, so let's take a break right now. We'll come back and start digging into the phone lines as we talk about the Henry Louis Gates Jr. and James Crowley meeting, which is set for 6 o'clock tomorrow at the White House, the Oval Office patio, in fact. We're talking about that and what it says about race in America, power and politics, all of that getting wrapped up in this, as we talk with Andra Gillespie, the Assistant Professor of Political Science at Emory University. And we always love to hear from you. You can reach us this morning at 1-800-642-1234 and tell us how you're viewing this. Are you hoping for a greater resolution than just a couple of people who agree that maybe they were both mistaken? Are you looking for more from this moment in America? The number 1-800-642-1234. I'm Veronica Rickert, in this week for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Veronica Rickert with you this morning for Kathleen Dunn, who's out this week on Wisconsin Public Radio. I hope you'll stay with me next hour as we talk with the director of a new documentary called Food Inc. The film says our food supply is controlled by just a handful of mega corporations that put profit first, ahead of consumer health, the livelihood of the American farmer, and a safe environment. That's coming up at 10 o'clock this morning. This hour, we're talking about the big meeting happening Thursday at 6 o'clock at the Oval Office between Henry Louis Gates Jr. and James Crowley, his arresting officer. And, of course, Barack Obama will be there, and we'll see what that yields and what America is expecting from this so-called teachable moment. We're talking with Andra Gillespie this morning, the Assistant Professor of Political Science at Emory University. And we'll head over to the phone lines now and take a call from Stephen in Westby. Hi, Stephen.
Hello. Hello, Ms. Rickert, Ms. Gillespie. Very interesting conversation you're having. I am a law enforcement officer, and I think what needs to be understood is that from what I am hearing, you have a law enforcement officer that's going in a situation where his life may be in jeopardy, and I think you had two gentlemen that are probably type A personalities, and an officer has to take control of a situation. And I'll have to admit, if an officer came into my home and was trying to take control of my home, even though he is under the guise that I may be breaking in, I'd probably get frustrated too. Mm-hmm. I think what you've talked about is two gentlemen that probably were both in the right. But as a law enforcement officer, when you go into a situation, you need to take control of the situation. Otherwise, someone else could get hurt. And that is probably the main concern of this law enforcement officer, is that he had to take control of a situation. I love the idea that our president, though, had a friend that he was going to stand up for no matter what.
So you respect him for that?
I do. I really do. I think he's doing an excellent job. And sticking up for a friend is okay by me. Even, you know, as a law enforcement officer, we get jumped on all the time. And we're told we do the wrong thing all the time. And you know what? That's okay. That's part of our job.
Stephen, what is your best case scenario for what comes from this White House meeting tomorrow?
I think it's just going to open up the whole thing with the race issue and the whole bit. Granted, there's racial profiling. I mean, that's just the way it is. It's reality. Now, in this situation here, I don't think the officer went in with the factor of racial profiling, but he went in with the fact that somebody had broken into a home, and he's going to want to go home that night. He doesn't know how the person is armed. He doesn't know if he's going to be confronting somebody that's going to be harming somebody else in the home. It's a it's a life-threatening situation no matter how you do it when you walk in.
You never know what's behind the door.
You never know.
All right. Well, thank you for your perspective, Stephen. We appreciate that.
You're welcome.
Andra Gillespie?
Well, first, I want to honor his service. You know, being a police officer is a thankless job, and it's a necessary job. And so I couldn't do what I, you know, do unless there were people there who were around to protect me. So I really appreciate the perspective. You know, nobody should fault Officer Crowley for answering a burglary call. Excuse me, that's his job. And when going in, he needs a certain amount of information about who to look for in terms of being able to apprehend suspects. And, you know, skin tone is one of those things that helps to identify people the same way height and weight and eye color and hair color are. And so in that respect in and of itself, it might not be, you know, this is where race in and of itself may not be an issue. I think where people have a problem with the Gates arrest was that Professor Gates was arrested after it was clear that no crime had taken place and after it was clear that the situation was safe. And so it seemed to be more about ego than it was about, you know, him actually being a threat to anybody else. There's also the issue of whether or not the cops lured Professor Gates out of the house so that they could arrest him. So once that they had determined that no crime had taken place, Professor Gates was perhaps berating these officers in their house, and they asked him to come outside because they could more easily talk on their radios outside of the acoustics of his kitchen. And once he was in a public space and continued to talk and yell at the police, that was when they had the grounds to be able to arrest him under disorderly conduct, because it's not disorderly conduct in the home unless Professor Gates is directly threatening the physical well-being of Officer Crowley and his backup. So, I mean, you know, this is where that gray area comes in as to whether it was ego or whether it was racially motivated, and that's not helped by the fact that Professor Gates was actually accusing Officer Crowley of racial profiling and yelling, "Are you doing this to me because I'm a black man?" and talking about his mama and doing all of these things that in hindsight he probably shouldn't have done. And so I think that that's where that gray area sort of comes in. In a perfect world for me, if I can imagine how I would have wanted Professor Crowley to have approached the situation, if he had gotten to the house, saw that Professor Gates was already in the house and it doesn't quite look like he's stealing, he should introduce himself as he says that he did, say that we have a report of a breaking and entering, which he did. Professor Gates should have said, "Well, I live here. Let me show you that I, in fact, live here." If he could say, "Look, we want to be sure that you're safe. Can we, you know, look around just to be sure that there really isn't a burglary in progress?" Because there could have potentially been burglars, you know, on a second floor that Professor Gates hadn't known about because he hadn't quite gotten upstairs yet or anything else. And then once he called everything in, was, you know, assured of the fact that there was no restraining order against Professor Gates at this particular house, as has been raised this week, that that's part of standard operating procedure, then everybody could have been polite, said, "Sorry to bother you, we just wanted to make sure that everything is okay, just doing our jobs," and kind of moved on from there. Unfortunately, that's not what happened, and that's why we're in the situation that we're in. And so because people's egos got in the way, because words were shared kind of between the two parties, you know, what ends up having a racial misunderstanding in the history of a country that does have a racial profiling problem, it ends up getting blown out of proportion. So, yeah, in hindsight, people would have, you know, given more information and explained more about what was going on, and folks would have, you know, been more calm about it. Unfortunately, we don't live in that perfect world. So now the question is, how do you deal with these situations going forward if you're ever caught in that type of situation?
Well, thank you so much for the call, Stephen. And we'll move on now to Sheree in Fond du Lac. Hi, Sheree.
Hi. Going beyond the issue with the professor, I think what we're facing right now is a lot of black fatigue. And what I mean by that is whenever someone is shot in the back while he's laying down with no weapons, it's always a black man. You know, while I think that every black person knows a black person that has been stopped or racially profiled or arrested without cause, period. Whenever you see, whenever I meet a person, a white person for the first time, somehow within the 5 minutes of the conversation, I'll hear, "Oh, I used to have a black friend. Oh, of course, I've had a lot of black friends. I've had black friends come to my house and eat." And the fact that they just mentioned it, let me know that it's on their mind. So it's something where we are just constantly hit in the face with how different we are treated. And it's something that we just, you know, we figure if Professor Gates, with his money and his thought process and his accomplishments, this can still happen to him, it can happen to every one of us. That's how we look at it.
I think that's a good point, Sheree. And you can see someone like Henry Louis Gates Jr. being exquisitely aware of the reality that Sheree is talking about and realizing that this is his moment when he is perceiving himself to be in that very scenario and maybe thinking, I'm going to jump on this for all it's worth and make a point.
Yeah, you know, I don't want to ascribe that type of instrumentality to Skip Gates. I mean, it's not outside of the realm of possibility, but I haven't spoken with him, so I don't know. What the good part that can come out about this is that the reality that Sheree talks about and the reality that I know as an African-American woman and as somebody who I know has, you know, experienced times when I thought that I've been treated differently because of my race, this is something that's very familiar to African-Americans, but it might not be as familiar to people outside of the African-American community or people outside of the Latino community who also deal with similar types of discrimination. And so as long as these stories stay within our specific racial and ethnic communities and they don't go outside, then people don't recognize sort of how prevalent these issues are. There was a poll done last year by CBS and the New York Times where they asked people about racial profiling. And overall, 43% of blacks reported that they had been stopped by the police because of their race. 30% of Latinos reported the same thing compared to 7% of whites. And when we compare white men and black men, it was 9% of white men and 66% of black men had reported being pulled over for what they thought was actually in part racially motivated reasons. When we think about those types of perceptual gaps, if black men and white men aren't talking to each other and if blacks and whites aren't talking to each other in general, or if when blacks tell their stories, they're not being validated by whites. If whites say, oh, you're making that up, or maybe it was for some other reason and always coming up with an excuse, then that's going to create an impasse, which is going to prevent us from going forward. So the good thing that Professor Gates can potentially do is that if he uses his platform, and particularly those PBS documentaries that he does, and he said that he's going to do this, to talk about racial profiling in a very meaningful way, and to sit and have people explain their stories in a way that's believable and compelling to a large audience, then maybe people across the country, regardless of their background and regardless of their experience with racial profiling, might actually sort of see this problem as being for real. But when we listen to the other side and completely delegitimize what they're saying and discount what they say to the point that we don't believe it, then that actually helps to perpetuate the problem. And I think for many people, when they hear this story, it's unfathomable to them because it's not their lived experience. And when you can discredit, in part, the source of some of this material by saying, well, Gates overreacted in the situation, that's why he got arrested, it didn't have anything to do with race, or in the case of some instances of racial profiling, sometimes some of the victims of racial profiling were also committing crimes if certain things happened, and so they're not actually the best example. So, when that kind of stuff happens, then it actually makes it harder for a meaningful discussion to go forward. So what I would encourage Professor Gates to do in the 6 months that he has before his next documentary comes out is to find real compelling stories, real believable stories that actually prick our pathos to the point that we actually believe that this is a real problem. Black people know that this is for real. Everybody's got a story. But in order for this to be meaningful at all, and in order for this to really be a teachable moment, people are going to have to see that this really does happen all the time and that black people aren't crazy when they talk about these stories of being harassed by the police.
There was an interesting op-ed piece in the Washington Post, I think it was by Eugene Robinson, who talked about how he thought this was about more than race and got into power politics, especially given that there is a black man in the White House and he was dealing with a professor who had an ego that seemed like it was a little outsized. Which apparently, you know, Eugene Robinson made the point that that wasn't not at all unusual in Harvard. This is what you see a lot with these professors who have these high profiles, and that maybe that power imbalance, a working class cop versus an intellectual elite, might have been what tipped the scales. What do you think about that?
I mean, I think that there is definitely some truth to that. And in Officer Crowley's police report, he does note that Skip Gates said, you don't know who you're messing with. And Gates apparently made some threats, probably directly related to his job, about how you potentially suggesting that he was going to get him fired. And, you know, it's not inconceivable that somebody in Professor Gates' position would have made such a comment and probably was even more indignant because of the fact that one would assume that in Harvard Square that your one connection with the university and your stature and profile would insulate you from being the victim of such racial attacks. Initially, when this happened, one of the things that's very interesting is that Lucia Whalen actually works for Harvard's alumni magazine. She doesn't write for the magazine, but dealing with that product, you would assume that she would know who Skip Gates was because of the fact that he's been featured in the magazine. Mm-hmm. And he's one of the most visible and prominent professors at the university.
Not to mention her neighbor.
Right. Well, and that she works right down the street from him. And that you forget that maybe she would know that. And you ask yourself, would Alan Dershowitz not be recognized? Or would David Gergen not be recognized? People who are also very high profile and on the faculty of Harvard University. And so, you know, that was the initial story. It seems like Ms. Whalen made a very good faith attempt to just be a good citizen and a good neighbor, and that there wasn't any racial animus at all kind of going into the situation. So I think that that probably contributed to Professor Gates being even more indignant than he would have been. And, you know, don't know the relationship between the Cambridge Police Department and people at Harvard University and whether there is a town gown divide and whether somebody would have wanted to take a Harvard person down a peg or two. Hmm. You know, you can't speculate about those kinds of things. But class could definitely be a part of it. One of the things that's very interesting about it, people always ask the question about why affluent and poor blacks tend to behave politically in very similar ways in terms of their voting behavior and in terms of their support for certain types of public policies. We do discern differences in support for certain types of public policies based on class within the African-American community, but the reason why the general story is a story of political unity is because in many instances, race still trumps class. So middle and upper class blacks are not shielded from racial discrimination because mm-hmm. of their money or because of their educational background. And this was a shining example of doesn't matter how high you get on the totem pole, you still are sometimes seen as just a black person, and then people notice your class status. And so that was a very important takeaway point, and that's the teachable moment that I would use in my class to explain why we see 90% of blacks voting, you know, Democratic in most elections, why we see middle-class blacks supporting social welfare policies that their class peers of other races tend not to support because they understand that sometimes race is actually more important than class.
Back to the phone lines now. Richard joining us from Fort Atkinson. Hi, Richard.
Yes, thank you. I'm one of the people from outside the African American or Latino community who know what one of your previous callers was talking about. When I heard President Obama use the word stupid, I was really pleased. And then I was profoundly irritated when he backpedaled and went off the subject. This case may not be a good case to hang a profiling argument on, but Mr. Crowley had the power of the gun. He had the power of the blue uniform. Gates is a little old guy with a cane in his own house. And so it seems to me that there is no doubt that the behavior of the police was unacceptably aggressive and stupid. But Obama and our media are guilty of something much larger. That is, there's really a lot of important stuff going on in this society which we are afraid to attend, and that is Oscar Morgan, Sean Bell, Diallo, all of the people who have recently been shot down by the police. I mean, lynching is alive and well in this country, and we do not want to confront that issue. And that's my point of view.
Richard, what are you hoping to come out of this meeting at the White House tomorrow?
Nothing.
Nothing.
I think it is a facade, and it's trivial. And if you listen to NPR just a little while ago with Juan Williams, he had a good problem, a good statement in the sense that he maintained that the issue is not really profiling, and there are too many factors which don't make that as a good basis for the argument. But I consider the case as an evasion of the problems that really confront us, and so we deal with these. Harvard professor gets confronted in his own house by a lower class cop, something like that. It just doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
All right. Well, thank you for your thoughts, Richard. Andra Gillespie.
I'm sympathetic to your point of view, and I admire your righteous indignation. And unfortunately, for this to truly become a national issue, one that actually, you know, compels legislation on a national level, you're going to have, unfortunately, another incident where a black or brown person gets, who's clearly innocent, gets mistreated by the police and gets killed. And it's probably going to take a moderate black leader coming to the defense. Look, we've seen the National Action Network, and we've seen Rainbow Push come to the defense of people like Amadou Diallo or Sean Bell. But because they are considered polarizing figures in American life and society, and because people sometimes unfairly characterize them as always playing the race card, people, it's almost like Chicken Little. Nobody pays attention sometimes when they actually advocate on behalf of people. So if another Sean Bell incident happens again, or an Amadou Diallo incident happens again, where clearly the victim was not committing any crime and was an upstanding citizen and gets killed because of a racial profiling tag, then if President Obama or another moderate black public official comes out, publicly takes this on as an issue, and publicly tries to see this legislation through Congress, then perhaps we can start to make some headway on at least a federal racial profiling law that's still not going to address issues at the state and local level, which is often where these issues happen. And so we hope that public officials can champion those issues in the proper jurisdiction to make sure that police officers get the proper training and that they learn to unlearn some of the things that society teaches them. I, like you, am not terribly optimistic that anything is national is going to come out of this particular instance, but I do hope that these men personally can come to a sense of racial reconciliation. And I think that's probably the best that we can hope for from Thursday, because I think a lot of people are tired of talking about this issue, and sometimes the fatigue of talking about the issue often keeps us from being able to make progress.
You know, I thought the same thing when we talked about producing this hour, but I have to say the phone lines have been completely full every second, so I wonder how tired we are about it, if there isn't a greater hunger to learn more from it.
I mean, there's something about the way that the story has been crafted that's been very fascinating. And it's been treated like a tabloid story, so it's always going to gather people's attention. And I think that, you know, on the grassroots level, that there are a lot of people who are willing to sit and talk about this issue and do the hard work about this. But, you know, eventually the feeding frenzy stops. So this has been, you know, almost 2 weeks in the news cycle. There's something else is going to happen. There are other issues that are salient, and there are a lot of people who think that that stuff is more important. And so sometimes racial issues nowadays in the post-civil rights era get pushed to the back burner because you still have to deal with the economy. You still have to deal with health care. People are going to care about housing and the stock market and all those other types of issues, and there are a lot of people who think that because this appears to be superficial or appears to be cosmetic or because it's not really clear-cut in this particular case, that it's going to be time to move forward. So sometimes it's going to take a real visceral crime where it's very clear who the good guys and the bad guys are in order for us to be able to move forward. And it's got to happen in such a way that everybody feels that they can take a national stake in it and not just this is the province of, you know, some stereotypical backwoods Southerner or the New York City Police Department. When people sort of realize that, you know, racial profiling happens all over the country, it happens, you know, in Mississippi, it happens in Michigan, it happens in Montana, then we can kind of be able to move forward. But oftentimes, you know, we, you know, have a very short attention span, and so our attention is about to, you know, wear thin on this particular issue, and we're going to move on to the next thing.
Okay, well, let's leave it there for a moment and take our last break here as we talk about the Henry Louis Gates Jr. meeting with Officer Crowley set to take place tomorrow at the Oval Office, on the Oval Office patio, to be exact, I guess, with beer. So we'll wait and see what happens there. And we're discussing what America wants to see come out of that meeting and what, if anything, we've learned from this. Our call-in number this morning, 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, and our email remains talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, glad to be with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. At 1 o'clock today on Wisconsin Public Radio, join us for Talk of the Nation. Sarah Palin, Joe Biden, and Kentucky Senator Jim Bunning are all making news this week. And after 1 on Talk of the Nation, sort it all out with NPR political junkie Ken Rudin. Veronica Rickert in today for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. As we talk about perhaps the final moments of the great drama between Henry Louis Gates Jr. and Officer James Crowley, they're set to meet at the White House tomorrow. And maybe we will see a resolution of some sort coming out of that. And we're wondering what you are hoping to see come out of that meeting and what we've learned about race and power politics in America. Our call-in number this morning is 1-800-642-1234. And let's start with Mike in Milwaukee, who sent an email that says, listeners must be aware that Barack Obama was racially profiled himself. He mentions it in his autobiography, The Audacity of Hope. So he probably experienced a visceral reaction and identification to Gates' arrest, and he is uniquely qualified to weigh in on the issue, and he should. Andra Gillespie, what do you think about that?
It's very interesting. Last night, Colin Powell was on Larry King Live. And he mentioned his own experiences with racial profiling. During this incident, I think a lot of us went back and thought about our own experiences with racial profiling. I got kicked out of a town during a research project on an anti-solicitation clause because my research involved my going door-to-door. And I'm pretty convinced that some neighbors in this community called the police and said, they're black people going door-to-door. Can you make sure that they're not trying to break into our house? And they were able to stop us from engaging in racial profiling. And I had... when I went to try to resolve the issue in a very calm and peaceable fashion by throwing out my Emory credentials and, you know, explaining that, you know, I'm a political scientist and I'm, you know, doing some political work in the neighborhood and, you know, I should be allowed to do this because of the First Amendment, I had the city manager of this little town in suburban Atlanta tell me, yeah, whatever, you might be right, but we are going to stop you from going door-to-door today. And they actually required that I provide, do an application, and at 4:45 on Friday, they weren't going to let me do it that day. So I couldn't do any work on my project that entire weekend, and it was actually pretty critical for the work that I was doing. I had to provide biometric information for everybody who was working with me, had to acknowledge any criminal histories of anybody who was working on my staff, had to provide addresses, places of birth. It was all kinds of personal information that didn't make any sense. And I remembered when the chief of police of this town walked into the office where I provided all of this information, I expected him to at least be friendly and acknowledge my presence. And he didn't. He wouldn't even look me in the face. And it's one of those things that you can't quite quantify, but you know in your gut if you've experienced it before. It was at that moment that the fact that I taught at Emory or the fact that I have a PhD from Yale didn't matter at all. I was just an N-word in this person's mind. And he just exuded bigotry, and he exuded hatred, and it didn't matter who I was. And I realized at that moment that there was no way I was going to be able to use my credentials to be able to plead my way out of this situation, and that I was just submissive and had to just go along to get along in order to do whatever, you know, it was to keep, you know, keep myself out of jail. So it was a very interesting sort of situation to have that moment kind of come to me. And, you know, I was born way after the Civil Rights Movement. I'm very young. I'm a beneficiary of the movement. I'm not supposed to experience racism, but I very much did. And this didn't happen 20 years ago. This happened about 2.5 years ago.
Well, that's interesting, too, because your story resonates with what Colin Powell said, I guess it was last night or recently, about his experience. And he said he's been stopped and, I guess, sort of hassled by police officers on the job, you know, for the White House at Reagan International Airport. He said to them he was clearly just a black man, but what he had been taught is that you respect the police. He even used the phrase, suck it up.
Right.
Which was interesting to me to see to hear someone at that that stature and profile in America still sort of give that advice out. He said, my mama taught me you respect the police, and that's what I still do.
Well, yeah, I mean, after a while, if you want to fight every racial slight or every supposed or, you know, even potential incidence of racial injustice, you would get tired or bitter. And so a lot of people choose to pick their battles or in the situation to try to de-escalate that situation by being polite and then going back and following up later. So if you were treated rudely, you know, in a store, and there's, you know, that you're not going to be able to reason with the person right there who's the direct cause of the racial incident, then maybe you go back and you write a letter to their manager, or you write a letter to, you know, the board of the particular store, and you explain what happened to them. Then you're doing it in a much more calm fashion. And a lot of Black people have developed those coping mechanisms. And in fact, in a lot of the both mainstream but in African-American press, there are people who have criticized Skip Gates for not following that protocol. It's a protocol that most Black kids, especially Black men, learn at some point in their lives. On the one hand, you understand that this makes perfect sense, but on one level, you need to challenge that. Why do Black and brown men have to learn how to, you know, appease the police when the police may, in fact, be being excessively aggressive and maybe behaving unjustly towards them? And so on the one hand, you can appreciate Skip Gates for having stood up to the police for what he perceived to be a racial slight. But on the other hand, you're like, wow, Skip, you could have saved yourself a trip to jail if you had just shut up and then gone back and pulled the Harvard card and, you know, filed a complaint against Officer Crowley. So it just reflects that there are two different approaches sometimes to attacking race. Some people, you know, are going to, you know, use a blunt object, and some people are going to use, you know, an excision knife. It doesn't mean that, you know, either of them is wrong. It just means that there are different approaches. And if the goal is to stay out of jail, then Professor Gates's approach is wrong. But occasionally, some people do have to go to jail in order to shine a light on this problem and in order to provide redress for this particular issue. So, you know, I don't want to say, you know, that General Powell was right or that, you know, or that Professor Gates is right. You oftentimes need both approaches in order to provide any sort of redress in the long term.
Let's take another phone call now. Mike is calling from Osseo. Hi, Mike.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Monica. How are you?
Good. I just want to, you know, when that, after Barack Obama made his, you know, his acted stupidly comment, I remember something in the news cycle that said that the Cambridge police said that they had, you know, a taped conversation of what occurred there, that the officer was recording it. And I just think that a lot of this could be put to rest if, you know, if that would come out. I don't know if that was the reason that we had that big backpedal from the president. You know, that he heard the tapes, like, oh, you know, maybe I need to back off of this a little bit. But, you know, I mean, we've heard the 911 tape, they released that, but, you know, I mean, don't you think that a lot of this could be resolved if they just, you know, if they have an actual recording of the incident, that would help?
Well, if I can jump in,
there
some of that has actually been released. And the parts of it that I have heard, you can hear Officer Crowley's voice very clearly, and you can hear somebody's voice in the background, but you can't hear what they're saying. So presumably it's Professor Gates. The police report says that while Crowley was in the house investigating and looking at the IDs, Gates was on the phone with the Harvard Property Management Office because they actually own his house and he's renting it from them. So what you could hear in the background is Gates on the phone with them. So the parts that I've heard, and I haven't heard the whole thing, you can't really hear the conversation going on between the two of them. You can hear what Crowley is actually saying back to the police dispatch. And so he's saying that Gates is uncooperative, and his tone is very even through the whole thing, but it's really hard to hear the other thing, even though I agree with you. And before this was released on Monday, I actually asked, have the tapes been released yet? And, yeah, so if the tapes come in and, you know, Skip Gates is threatening to kill somebody, then clearly this is not the right case about racial profiling, and all of this definitely should die because it's going to be very embarrassing to him.
Well, on the other hand, maybe it doesn't matter what the tapes say. It seems as though the bigger issue is that both sides learn to hear each other, maybe open up dialogues, maybe some sort of town hall style conversations about race across the nation.
Yeah, that would definitely be helpful. And, you know, maybe that'll happen on college campuses in other places in the country, but, you know, this is happening during the summer. People are going to go off to try to do their final summer barbecues. You know, it's going to take a lot of effort and a lot of initiative and a lot of proactive activity in order for this to stay in the forefront of the minds of many people. So the challenge is, if you are committed to anti-racism, if you are committed to racial reconciliation, is to use this moment. But don't expect Barack Obama, Skip Gates, and Jim Crowley to be the ones at the forefront of doing that. It's now the responsibility of people at the local level to use this opportunity as a teaching moment.
I think think we have time for one more call. Dave in Crawford, could I ask you to keep it short, please?
Yes, I have a whole bunch of points, but I'm going to just stick with a couple. Everybody, there's a rule of law and there's a letter of law. We're all bound by that, and officers too. And nobody seems to be looking into the color of law, which is it's a law. It's a part of an employment. I'm 25 years, and the president won't invite me to the White House, and I still have legal battles. And nobody looks at the color of law. They look at the color of a person's skin, and I'm not black.
Dave, I'm sorry. We've got to leave it there so our guest can answer and we can bid her goodbye. Andra Gillespie, do you want to respond quickly? We've got about 10 seconds for your answer.
Well, it's very important to see whether or not laws are applied fairly across groups, across gender groups, and across racial groups. We've achieved equality when you don't see disproportionate treatment of blacks or Latinos or Asian Americans or whites or any other group based on that. And so this incident can help us to sort of see whether or not the law gets applied differently to different people based on the color of their skin.
Professor Gillespie, thank you so much for your time this morning. It's been great to talk to you.
Thank you.
Andra Gillespie is an assistant professor of political science at Emory University. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for producing this hour, Brittany Deanna for answering your phone calls. I'm Veronica Rickert on Wisconsin Public Radio.